Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. We have a very special episode today. It's actually not going to be a full hour. Actually, it never is. It's only around 52 minutes, but it's going to be even less, probably about 30 minutes, but it's going to be okay. Why? Because we have an extremely special guest, somebody who's not even with us in his earthly form anymore. And who is this special somebody? Mr. Kurt Vonnegut. He, for those of you who do not know, is a very popular writer, essayist, playwright. He's done many different things. He was an honorary president of the American Humanist Association for many years, and he actually won the Humanist of the Year Award in 1992, where he gave a phenomenal speech. And you could find that on thehumanist.com as well. This interview was actually pulled from the archives. I don't know if it's been aired or what the story is with it. All I know is that the American Humanist Association does own the rights to this, and it was conducted by a humanist who is with the organization today, Dan Moran. Now, I date this interview back to about 1998, and how I got that date is, actually, it's quite complex, but it had to do with listening to what was said, determining dates based on certain events and so forth, and also the date was written on the CD. So here's Dan Moran with his interview with Kurt Vonnegut.
Hi, this is your literary correspondent, Dan Moran, and welcome to the Long Island Radio Magazine. I must begin by telling you all that this is a most special day indeed, and confess that despite my frequent excursions beyond my prescribed role here on WPBX, both my heart and my fond allegiance still go to the writers among us. I had decided some time ago, without necessity of second thought, that were I to conduct but one more interview on this program and call it a career, I knew for certain who would be my most favored subject. Happily, the show will definitely go on, but today I have beside me, or across from me as it were, one of the great men of American letters who, aside from being a wordsmith of the first order, is one of the great raconteurs and commentators on this world of ours. Kurt Vonnegut has achieved cult status as the author of such titles as Cat's Cradle, God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, Welcome to the Monkey House, Happy Birthday, Wanda June, Breakfast of Champions, Slapstick, Slaughterhouse 5, Deadeye Dick, Bluebeard, Hocus Pocus, and his most recent, Fate's Worse Than Death. His next offering, which he has proclaimed to be his last, is called Timequake and is scheduled for release on September the 22nd. He is a man of sharp wit, incisive perspective, and a well-deserved wisdom, and we are fortunate here on Long Island's East End to call him Neighbor. A sincere welcome to you, Kurt Vonnegut.
Thank you. That's a scary introduction.
I hope I never scared you too much.
No, I can't be funny, for heaven's sakes.
You can't? I'm hoping that you will be.
Raconteur is not today.
No, not today. All right, well, I'm going to see if I can charge up your raconteur side a little bit. I'm certain that the attention for your self-proclaimed last book called Timequake will be overwhelming, and deservedly so, but I'm immediately curious how one comes to the conclusion that one has said all one needs to say. Is this really a farewell from Kurt Vonnegut?
Well, Herman Melville said that about whalers, you know. Is whalers don't talk, and the reason is that they have said absolutely everything they could say. And I'm almost 75. I'll be 75 in November. And I'm very lucky. My books are all in print, so in fact I am not silent. And I've managed to say about everything
you don't
I
think
wanted to say.
Maybe next year something else might come up that you might be interested in saying?
Yeah, but the body of my work is behind me, and as an actuarial matter, is male writers, male American writers, have done their best work by the time they're 55. And that was a long time ago for me.
Uh-huh.
And that was, I think Huckleberry Finn was Mark Twain's. He was probably about 53 when he wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his masterpiece. And then not much good after that.
Well, you know, you've had an amazing career, and some people are fortunate to write one successful book. Some very lucky ones will be remembered for that. And you've gone so far beyond that to the point where your books are likely classics almost even before you finish writing them. It seems that affixing your name to it almost guarantees the success of it. Does this sort of play into your feelings when you're writing these things? I mean, are you worried that it's become, the success has become seemingly easy for you?
Yeah, it's a little embarrassing because for instance, this book, Timequake, I tried to write it for, I guess, 8 years, and in fact turned in a finished manuscript, and it appeared in Putnam's catalog is coming out. This was, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and I decided it was really a piece of junk, and I promise you it was, and, you know, I didn't want to wind up my career publishing junk.
I can assure the listeners that I've read it, and it is far from being junk. There were many times that I had to put it down and laugh out loud and try to recompose myself, even sitting in a room by myself, so I was very impressed.
Oh, boy.
You know, I would say that... You had made a statement once that a plausible mission of artists is to make people appreciate being alive a little bit. And you suggest at one point that the Beatles managed to pull that off. And, of course, I love the Beatles, but was there anybody else you think that has reached that status, especially in the last maybe 20 or 25 years?
Well, of course, thanks to electronics, to recordings and radio and then TV, is they were able to reach millions of people, and before 1920, say, when radio became powerful and reached into all homes, there was no way for any sort of artist to reach a really large audience. Mm-hmm. And when they showed up, and I was no teenager when they showed up. I had teenage kids, and all generations were elated by this music, and God, what a terrible thing to have shot John Lennon.
Yeah, I agree with that. I can't ever remember anything quite so euphoric as when the Beatles arrived in New York, and all the excitement and the radio people following them from the airport into the city to their hotel. It was very exciting. And, of course, the appearance on Ed Sullivan. But... Where writers are concerned, is there somebody today who's maybe early in their career that you really admire, that you think has got a tremendous amount of potential, or that you're very fond of?
Well, my field is not like medicine, as I don't have to keep up with the latest developments, and I'm as likely to read a book tomorrow that was written 50 or 100 years ago as I am to read what a youngster is reading now, but... The audience for which I wrote, and for which Mailer wrote, and Irwin Shaw and James Jones, is the guys all born around 1922, has vanished. Mm-hmm. We were the last writers to respond to other books. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote books, and here, this Timequake, this last book, there's no way it could be made into a movie or a TV series. It's a book and can only entertain in that form. And novels of old people, 25, 30, 35, 40 now, are responsive to film and to TV. And should be. I mean, that's what's going on now. And so the novel, the ink stains on flattened wood pulp, they are no longer an important form of entertainment. Is TV is a much more effective entertainer, I'm afraid.
Is this somehow killing literature, though? I mean, are there any Hemingways or F. Scott Fitzgeralds or Faulkners among us today?
Well, it would discourage the creation of new literature, and literature may no longer be possible, as this used to be a source of enormous nourishment, spiritual nourishment and entertainment for a large part of our population, particularly in the Northern Europe and Northern United States, where there's nothing else to do in the wintertime. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's all over with now, so the audience doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And when I started out, when I became a writer, a professional writer, quit a regular job and became a freelance, which would be around 1950, it was still possible to create a sensation with a book. There was that possibility to hit a home run in Yankee Stadium. And there's no book now can set a large part of the population on its ear, is thrill them. That opportunity is gone.
You know, one of the things that you had stated in Timequake was that for you, one of the three great questions in life was sort of stepping back after you've completed your large body of work and say to yourself, how the hell did I do that? Is this indeed one of the great revelations that must become apparent to anyone who creates art, that the creation of art is almost a mystery to the person who does it?
Oh, yes. I think the, well, sculptors, I've talked to sculptors, and they have a really spooky feeling that somebody else is using their hands, you know. And what if you look at Michelangelo's Pietà? Somebody took charge of his hands. Otherwise, this thing would have been impossible. And yes, I think that every artist, except lunatics, I guess, and there are a few, feels that he or she is really not entitled to do this, you know. Really, I'm not this smart.
Does this play into a description that, that you had made, that there were two kinds of writers, the swoopers and the bashers? Might you explain what that means?
Well, this is just a technical matter, and I have taught creative writing, and it can be taught to a certain extent. I taught 2 years at Iowa and a year at Harvard and a year at City College. But it swoopers, and they're more commonly women than men, go through, write the whole novel any which way, you know, going real fast, and then they're going to fix whatever needs fixing. And the bashers, and I happen to be a basher, is page one, page one, page one, page one. Okay, page one is all right now. Now we go on to page two. But when I finish a book, the book is indeed done. And, you know, the swoopers, I think, frequently find themselves unable to finish what they roughed out.
It's hard to know when to stop, I think, if you're going to spend a lot of time editing and rewriting things. I can tell you that I've always felt the best things that I wrote are the things that happened just naturally and that I didn't have to think about and perhaps didn't even understand that well until sometime afterwards.
Yeah.
Maybe that's sort of similar to what you're describing. You know, only a few days ago, perhaps the other great literary cult figure of the 20th century beside yourself, in my mind, was William Burroughs.
Yes.
What was your feeling about William Burroughs and his significance
well,
in the whole picture?
Well, I was roughly part of that generation, and I thought you might say Allen Ginsberg. Is the Beatniks really suffered two terrible losses there.
Well, only because Burroughs was the, you know, the great experimental novelist.
Yes, he was. Yeah. And I thought maybe you were going to say Allen Ginsberg, because the Beatniks, the Beat generation, suffered two catastrophic losses in the last couple of months.
And they were perhaps the last two of that generation.
Yes, the last high quality, I think, because Naked Lunch, whether written on drugs or whatever, I don't know, is a very important book. And I wrote a piece which had to be read at a memorial service for Alan in at Los Angeles. It was about a month ago. Somebody else had to read it because I was out of the country. But the first line on it was, please, please, nobody else die. Because I felt deprived, really, with Alan gone.
Yeah.
And less so, really, with Burroughs gone. He was less a public person.
Yeah, I would imagine that Allen Ginsberg was probably perhaps the last famous poet, maybe after Robert Frost. I can't imagine that there's too many people who've achieved the celebrity status that he has, or the, you know, the name recognition among the general public.
Well, he was a lovely performer and a genuinely affectionate man, and like the Beatles, cheered people up. I've seen him do it, the crowd, with his little musical instrument,
right,
and
right.
Going and getting the whole audience, and people feel better. I love it when the arts make people feel better.
I guess that should be the point of it in a way, right? It should make you happy to be alive in a lot of ways.
Well, you might educate people, too. I would rather just make them feel better, I think. Mm-hmm.
This is sort of tangential to that last question, but you also stated that if you really want to hurt your parents and you don't have the nerve to be homosexual, at least the least you can do is go into the arts. I don't know if what you might say more about that. What does that say for artists or homosexuals, for that matter?
Well, no, the parents want their children to be straight and to be financially successful. Artists famously fail, almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And even the greatest is when I teach, as I say, the icon of this course is Vincent van Gogh, who sold in his whole lifetime only two paintings, both to his brother Theo.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he would not stop, as he was inspired, and of course they're wonderful paintings. But almost everybody fails, and I say in lectures that the creation of the artistic part of our culture is like a World War I attack, where everybody goes over the top at dawn,
mm-hmm.
and almost everybody winds up face down, drowned in a shell hole, draped over barbed wire, and a few people get through.
Mm-hmm.
But I have survivor syndrome, not because of the Second World War, but because of all the really good writers
mm-hmm.
who failed.
Yeah. You know, it seems today, I don't know if it's just my own sense of it, but it seems like everybody wants to be a writer or a painter or a poet today, and there are all sorts of people who use those words to describe themselves, and I'm not sure what to make of that. Do you have any opinion on why the world seems to be so populated with all these creative people?
Well, I guess it's... You can't keep that up very long without producing, but I guess it's sexy, is you know, in single bars and all that. What do you do? Well, I'm a poet, I'm a painter and all that. They're on the internet, you know, who am I talking to? Well, I'm a poet, or I'm... Of course, you look in the yellow pages of the Manhattan Directory under producer, and there are thousands of names there. What do you do? I'm a producer.
That's an easy answer. You know, one of my favorite things to sit and look through is Bartlett's familiar quotations, and I should tell you that on page 901 in the 125th anniversary edition is a fellow named Kurt Vonnegut Jr. How did it feel to see your name in there? Did that matter at all to you that
well,
you had reached
that? Of course.
That?
No, I'm not insensitive to that sort of thing, but I'm also in the Webster Merriam Collegiate Dictionary in the back. And there was a time, it's sure, all this matters. My Lord, I'm from Indianapolis. And my brother, Bernard, who died just a few months ago, he and I were one above the other in Who's Who for a long time. And then he stopped filling out his form or anything, and mm-hmm. I assumed he had died. But I love that. If Bernie and myself, one over the other, in the name of our parents, you know, Edith and Kurt Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. Edith and Kurt
Vonnegut. He was a physicist or an engineer?
He was a hell of a physicist. He had a PhD in physical chemistry from MIT. But he's working in the research laboratory at General Electric with a great man named Irving Langmuir, another scientist named Vince Schaefer, and they were physicists, essentially, sitting around at lunch talking about the weather. This is in Schenectady.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out they didn't know anything about it. And so they went and got the Britannica, you know, to find out what makes it thunder. And all that with the clouds bumping into each other, what was it? And they realized that very little was known about the weather, and they wondered what the hell makes it rain. What makes the clouds decide to let go? And so they speculated, and they experimented with a cold box, which is a deep freeze with the lid open, but with really cold air in there, and a piece of dry ice. And they passed the dry ice through it, and the crystals fell out. So it is very interesting. General Electric had a These guys are physicists, incidentally, not meteorologists. Mm-hmm. And General Electric has an airfield there in Schenectady and some little planes. So they went up in a little plane and with bags of dry ice, and they flew over a cloud which was over Mount Greylock, which is right on the border between Connecticut and New York. It's very close to Albany. And they had the pilot fly a circular path. They threw dry ice out the back, and then they looked out where they'd been, and here was this racetrack. So that was the beginning of it. And then my brother found out that Silver Iodide, whose crystals very closely resemble those of ice, does the same damn thing.
Hmm.
Triggers clouds. And he has the patent on that. But as I say, he died a couple of months ago. He was 81, 82. And guess what's going to be done with his ashes?
Dropped through a storm cloud, probably, right?
An airplane is going to go up and going to fly a circle over Mount Greylock. And I love that idea. And my brother knew about it before he died, and he thought it was a pretty good idea, too.
What sort of a send-off would you like for yourself? Have you thought about that at all?
Well,
not that we're planning that just yet.
Well, you know, a group of English poets realized what a great poet Walt Whitman was, and he wasn't that appreciated here. And so they passed the hat in England and got quite a sizable amount of money because they heard he was very poor. And they visited him, and I think he was living in a room, probably in Philadelphia. And so they gave him a sizable purse of money, and he spent it on a mausoleum for himself. And I think what I would like is
something ostentatious.
Yes, I hope so.
A lot of gold leaf and things like
yes.
that. Maybe a nice marble statue.
Yes.
Several stories high. You know, in that same edition of the Bartletts, I'm always amused, and you as one of the leading figures in the humanist movement might be able to comment on this, but there are 48 pages in Bartlett's Familiar Quotations devoted to the two testaments of the Bible and 66 pages to Shakespeare. Aside from the fact that apparently Shakespeare is more quotable than Almighty God, what might it say about us, or what might it say about Shakespeare?
What it says... Yes, you're right. The Bible was never there to be poetical. I mean, on occasion it was, in the Psalms, surely. But it was there to inform, and we, in fact, don't know what the original Bible was and who the hell wrote any of it. And so the works of Shakespeare is a man intent, word after word after word, to entertain and amaze. But what I've said in Time Quake 2 is that Shakespeare may not have been the greatest poet of his age in England, that there is another one that nobody ever talks about. And
who is that?
Well, he's the man. Here's a sample of his work. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And so on, the 23rd Psalm. And this is a translation into English by Launcelot Andrews, a contemporary of Shakespeare, and he supervised the translation of Greek, Hebrew, and Latin into what you said was the voice of God. And so, of course, we think God sounds like the King James Bible, but it's in fact the language of Launcelot Andrews, and the 23rd Psalm is a Lulu.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's very beautiful, yeah. And, of course, often quoted, right? I wanted to see, you know, from the standpoint of life in America, I know that they say that anybody who's lived through a majority of the 20th century has seen an enormous amount of change occur. And I know that you were around for most of it. What is your feeling about the future of America? Are her best days behind her, or do you feel optimistic about the future?
Well, no, not particularly, but I look back at the past and have a reason to be astonished added, and particularly just only in the past 50 years, very close to the end of this century, of this millennium, civil rights for minorities. And I spoke at a memorial, at a birthday celebration for Eudora Welty a couple of years ago, and I think she was then 85 or something like that. And well, let's say she was born in 1911. At that time, she was closer to the atrocity of human slavery than we are to the Holocaust now, to the atrocity of the Holocaust. And only in 1919 did women get the vote. Can you beat it?
No,
and,
I think...
and so, yes, these are extraordinary. And I've said, I talk about the decline in racism because it was really something. Is the NAACP used to publish a scoreboard every year of how many people had been lynched, black people. And, you know, it used to be 34, and now it's 29, and maybe we're getting somewhere.
little by little, I hope, yeah.
Bit by bit.
Now, you know, we were talking for a moment about your own, perhaps your own epitaph, and if of all the wonderful and amazing things you've done, if there's one thing that you really wanted to be remembered for that you thought was your shining moment, what would it be? A particular book or an essay or a story you had written? Or maybe something having nothing to do with writing?
One time, I sang Stardust so beautifully.
Did you really? Where was that?
It was at a party, and frankly, I'd had a couple of drinks, and I decided to do it. And God, it was lovely, as I remember. Of course, this is Hoagy Carmichael, who's from Indiana, as I am. Would you like me to do it? On...
Sure. You want to sing a bar or two of Stardust?
No, I need a couple of drinks first.
All right. Well, I don't know if we have time, unless bottled water will do the trick for you. I don't know. Now, you know, one of the
bees.
Go ahead.
Beside a garden wall, when stars are bright, you were in my arms. A nightingale told his fairy tale, and I am with you once again. Now, that is pretty good.
That was
it?
Absolutely gorgeous. As a matter of fact, I'm tearful listening to it. Now, you know, I thought one of the things you'd want to be remembered for is that I understand that you were a decorated veteran of World War II.
Yeah.
Is that something that you want to be remembered for? I know that you had a hard time over there. You won a Purple Heart, am I right?
Yes. But I hear that I can just mail away for a Bronze Star if I want it, because I actually saw a German. And... No, it's everybody came out decorated. Of writers who've written war books, is the only one I know. This, I'm just talking about Heller and Jones and Irwin Shaw and Norman Mailer and myself, Gore Vidal, is the only one of us who's got a medal worth of damn is Joe Heller.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got an air medal, I believe.
So he really was in the action, huh?
Well, he did something pretty good. As I think the event, which is in Catch 22, where they're supposed to bomb a bridge and they miss for some reason, they circle back to go after it a second time, and they needn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's what he got his decoration for.
You know, here at the radio station, we're just after trying our best to raise a little bit of money to keep things going around here. Would you like to make some statement for the record on the current debate in Congress about the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities and the wonderful direction the Republicans are taking the artistic community into at the moment?
Well, I think artists have mixed feelings about the NEA, too. And one thing is the amounts of money are so minuscule that they really don't help anybody very much, and politicians can raise a stink about it. I'm sure that Jesse Helms has any number of nitwits persuaded that I'm getting a check every month from the government because I'm writing, you know, and somebody else is getting a check for painting pictures and so forth. But I, of all industrial nations, we invest the least in the arts. And I would support public radio and public television.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are in real trouble always are the ballet companies and the symphony orchestras. And I would support them nobly. I was on the New York State Arts Council for, I don't know, 7 years, something like that, with Kitty Hart as my boss. Greatest civil servant New York State ever had. She never got paid a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, under the New York State Constitution, we could not give individuals money. Can you imagine what politicians would do with that opportunity? And we had to give it to institutions, and then the institutions could give it to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, please keep the NEA to support symphony orchestras, the ballet companies, art museums.
And poets.
Oh, please.
Well, I had to slip that in. Well, Kurt Vonnegut, speaking with you has had the same effect as reading your stories. We can only guess with great anticipation what might be next. And I still think there's going to be something next, despite your proclamation about this being your last book. For now, what will be next is the late September release of Timequake by Putnam. I can promise you all, after reading The Galley, that no one will be disappointed. I wish you well with it, Kurt, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.